Poetic license, the liberty taken by an artist or a writer in deviating from conventional forms or rules to produce a desired effect. My name is Taria Autry, and starting February 2nd, I'll be hosting a one-hour show on KBOO, the first Monday of every month from 10 p.m. to 11 p.m. Join me on a spoken word adventure as I seek out the poetics of life in the Northwest and beyond while I travel. Hey, I may be moving from Portland soon, but you know I couldn't ever really leave ya. So tune in the first Monday of the month here on KBOO Portland, 10 p.m. to 11 p.m.
The time is 5 p.m. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next, it's the KBOO Evening News.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Oregon Legislature began its regular session today, and police accountability, background checks for gun owners, and marijuana regulation are all on the agenda.
We'll get an update from Ukraine, where U.S. troops appear to be advising the Ukrainian forces.
Palestine files charges against Israel at the International Criminal Court.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, February 2nd, 2015. I'm Jackie Malmstrom.
And I'm Ken Jones. Animal rights activists held a protest this afternoon outside the Portland office of Skanska USA, located at the Coin Center at Southwest 3rd and Columbia. The protest was organized by Portland Animal Liberation, a group which opposes Skanska's contract to build the new $100 million underground animal lab for the University of Washington. Animal activists around the country have begun to increase pressure against Skanska USA. Protests have been held in Seattle, Portland, the Bay Area, Los Angeles, San Antonio, Atlanta, and other cities. This past weekend in the Seattle area, protesters disrupted the company's operations on Friday, then held two protests outside of the homes of people involved in the enterprise. Chris Toer, the executive vice president of Skanska's Seattle office, saw protesters gather outside his home on Saturday night. The protesters took over the street in front of Chris's house with signs, banners, and bullhorns. His whole neighborhood heard about his office's involvement in the plans to build a new lab. Activists also left messages for Chris in chalk on the street, such as, "No new lab," "Stop animal torture," and "Your company, your fault." Following that demonstration, activists decided to surprise Bill Ayer, the chair of the University of Washington's Board of Regents, with a similar protest outside of his home. The planned animal research facility at the University of Washington would triple the size of the university's primate testing program. Opponents point to a record of poor treatment of animals at the university's existing labs and argue that there should be no expansion of the testing facility. Many of the protesters are opposed to animal testing for ethical reasons, saying that the practice constitutes unnecessary cruelty to animals.
The city of Gresham today installed a flashing light at the crosswalk in front of Centennial High School. They decided to expedite the installation of the light after two accidents in 2 days. On January 14th and 15th, caused four students to be injured. For more, KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with Sam Brewer, the superintendent of the Centennial School District.
Sam, can you tell us what led to the decision to put in a safety beacon outside of Centennial High on Southeast 182nd?
Sure. First, I would say that the installation was always planned for next summer. It was just moved up when in mid-January, on January 14th, we had one student in the morning hit by a car while crossing, and then the very next day in the afternoon, we had three girls hit while crossing as well. And that led us to work closely with the city, and they sped up their timeline for that installation.
Wow, so two accidents, 2 days in a row.
Correct.
Is that a site where there have been previous accidents as well?
You know, at the time I was saying that in my 7 years in Centennial, I was not aware of any accident that had happened there, and we actually went back and checked, and no one had been hit in that crosswalk since 2003. So it had been a 10-year period with no accidents, and then two in 2 days.
Wow. And what kind of features are in place already? Are there signs saying that there's a school crossing?
Yeah. So prior to the installation today, it is a school crossing. There are school crossing signs. Both accidents, however, happened outside the normal school crossing hours. The morning accident was a student arriving early for a wrestling practice. And then the next day, the accident was for students who were leaving after staying for an after-school program. So they were crossing when the school crossing flashing lights were not flashing.
And can you tell us about that stretch of Southeast 182nd? Is it an area where cars are going pretty fast?
It is. It's a pretty fast area. It's a 40-mile-per-hour zone in general, a very busy street. With our population growth out here, drivers have gone faster and faster on that street in recent years.
And are there other streets that are problematic in school zones in the Centennial District that you're working on trying to get some support from the city on?
You know, the city has been great to work with, and in general, I would say in most places we have crossing lights where they're needed, so there aren't any other problem areas specifically that I'm aware of.
What would be your message to drivers in the area or driving around school zones?
Yeah, well, in our area specifically, but in all school zones, you know, in a school zone, kids will be kids. And so we are working with our students to make sure that they're aware of crossing safety and they practice good crossing. But for drivers, please just slow down in school zones.
What's the status of the students who were injured? Are they recovering okay?
They are recovering okay. We're very thankful no one was killed. And while they all have injuries and recovery ahead of them, they're all going to be okay.
Well, thank you so much. Again, I've been speaking with Sam Brewer. He is with the Centennial School District. He's the school superintendent there out in Gresham. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
In Oregon news, the state legislature began its bi-yearly legislative session in Salem today and will be considering dozens of bills in the next several months. The Oregon legislature holds a session of about 4 months every 2 years. The session, which begins today, must end by July 11th, but could finish earlier. Both the House and Senate of the Oregon State Legislature have a Democratic majority this year, and there are a number of environmental and campaign finance bills on the table, as well as the state budget that must be negotiated in the coming months. The regulation of the new legal marijuana market will be up for review, and a bill requiring background checks for gun owners is also expected to be proposed at this session.
The Oregon State Legislature began its 2015 session today. One of the biggest issues facing the legislature this year is how to regulate Oregon's marijuana industry. The Oregon Liquor Control Commission, which has been charged with overseeing the regulated marijuana industry, will ask lawmakers to give the agency peace officer authority so agents can enforce the state's marijuana regulations. Oregon's new law, which legalizes recreational marijuana, gives the OLCC regulatory authority over cannabis production, processing, and sales. But it does not include a provision for peace officers to enforce the regulations, making the commission somewhat of a toothless tiger, according to the commission chairman, Rob Petridge, who is also the Klamath County District Attorney. If the legislature acts in favor of the commission's request, the peace officers would be able to carry out stings to catch rogue operators. They would also be allowed to seize marijuana from licensed facilities that violate these state rules. The OLCC is currently holding listening sessions throughout the state on the issue of legalized marijuana. The first sessions were held last week in Baker City and Pendleton, and another session was held today in Salem. For a complete list of the listening sessions, you can go to the OLCC website, oregon.gov/OLCC.
At a legislative town hall meeting this weekend at Portland Community College, several Oregon State legislators heard from local residents and outline their priorities for the legislative session that starts today. Representative Lou Frederick, who represents North and Northeast Portland, said that police violence is a national problem that must be addressed here in Oregon as well. He also addressed the issue of affordable housing.
For me, it's a personal situation in some ways. I don't know of a single black man in the country who has not had to deal with a concern when they see the blue lights behind them. For me, I always immediately think, am I going to die today? So this is something that we're going to have. We're going to have some discussion of, and you will see a number of bills. There are three bills right off the top, 2001, 2002, and 2003. Again, thank you, Speaker, for making sure that that's the case. I have several other bills that deal with excessive use of force, that deal with cameras, both the cameras on, potentially cameras, body cameras, as well as the ability for citizens to take pictures of what's going on and not be accused of interfering with that kind of force. So I also have a bill that I'm particularly interested in. I want to have a regular psychological evaluation of every law enforcement officer. There are several bills that have been introduced. I've introduced several of them. We are talking about the need. I think my preference at this particular point, I'll give you my preference, and that is that we have a system where we do not allow anyone who's working in the jurisdiction of an incident to be the ones doing the investigation of the incident. So it should not be someone from Multnomah County, for instance, doing the investigation of what takes place in Portland. It should not be necessarily somebody from Washington County either, but we need to have somebody who is an expert in investigation, doing the investigation. And I like the idea of it being under the auspices of the Attorney General's office rather than necessarily a special prosecutor. But I have also introduced a bill calling for a special prosecutor. We need to have some kind of option that we can, in fact, have someone who is going to be independent doing the investigation of any incident. And so there are several different approaches that we can take on that, and I want to see what happens as we talk in the legislature, how we work some things out. Cost. Does a special prosecutor require a cost to the Attorney General's office? Maybe not. If the Attorney General's office is the coordinator for something like that, the investigation was going to have to take place anyway, so the county that it's involved in would have to be paying for it. They should be paying for that investigation. So I want to have us look at those particular approaches because we need to have some kind of independent investigation system for any incident that takes place in the state of Oregon. One of the things that I discovered as we were knocking on doors during the election is, frankly, the concern. I could tell which homes had been there for a while and the real concern about some of the stairs going up and down. Now I have my back has went out a while ago because of an accident. Going up and down some of the stairs in some of the homes in my neighborhood was really a concern, and there was no way for some of those folks to get repairs and maintenance. The city has decided to put a small amount, in my view, $4 million into a fund to try to help with some of those repairs, but we need to go out and find some way to do that. Now, here's another aspect of that. Some of those repairs could be done by people who live in the neighborhood, which are giving jobs to those folks in the neighborhood. Let's make sure that we connect those things as well. So I'm looking at that. We have to figure out how we're going to not only make sure that we have housing for low-income folks, but frankly, we need to make sure that we are actually getting jobs for people. I want to have, it is not an either-or situation. We need to have both, and that's what I'm trying to find a way to not balance it, to try to make sure that we have both in the community. So that's what I'm looking at. It's not just the housing. It's not just one thing, but we've got to work on both of them. Thank you.
That was Oregon State Representative Lou Frederick, who represents North and Northeast Portland, speaking at a legislative town hall meeting today in North Portland.
The cable TV giant Comcast has been accused of ghostwriting numerous letters from politicians in support of the Comcast-Time Warner merger deal. This merger is valued at more than $45 billion. The online investigative journal Verge has discovered that dozens of letters written by politicians around the country in favor of the merger were in fact written by Comcast executives. The letters were given to the politicians for their signature before being sent to the FCC as an official statement of support for the merger. The exposé revealed that Oregon Secretary of State Kate Brown sent a letter of approval for the Comcast merger. The letter, written on official State of Oregon letterhead and featuring her official title along with the Oregon State seal, was sent to the FCC praising the positive virtues of the proposed merger. Except for three sentences, the letter in support of the merger from Brown was found to be exactly the same as dozens of other letters signed by elected politicians, but found to have been written by Comcast executives. Other politicians who sent similar ghostwritten letters in support of the Comcast-Time Warner merger included more than six U.S. governors and Rahm Emanuel, the mayor of Chicago. Kate Brown has received extensive campaign contributions from Comcast over the last few years, totaling more than $10,000, and is considered a leading candidate for the 2018 governor's race in Oregon. The city of Portland wrote a letter against the Comcast merger, arguing that the merger would increase prices, deter competition, and reduce output.
And now, we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at LaborRadio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. The United Steelworkers say that the oil refinery strike at nine facilities in Texas, California, and Kentucky is about safe staffing levels, and wages are not the primary focus. Tom Conway is a vice president with USW International.
This strike is about safe staffing levels inside the refineries and staffing levels of our maintenance workforces, and having safe and reliable and efficient staffing in the refineries. And the situation that exists today just has become unacceptable. We have people who are working 12, 14, 16, 18 continuous days without a day off on 12-hour shifts, and people are stressed with an amazing amount of overtime and fatigue and sleep deprivation. It's dangerous. It's a dangerous way to run an operation like a fuel refinery.
Conway says the USW didn't want the strike and is ready to immediately return to the bargaining table.
We didn't seek this strike. We're not looking for it, but we need problems solved, and just an intransigent attitude from them isn't going to get us there. It's not going to solve the problem. So hopefully they look at these in a genuine way and come back and are willing to sit with us and have an honest discussion about how do we make sure we have a well-trained, adequate workforce. They don't seem to us to be difficult discussions that a management should be so unwilling to have with its workforce.
The United Steelworkers represent workers at 65 U.S. oil refineries that produce about 64% of the country's refined oil. The USW was in negotiations with Shell Oil as part of a national pattern bargaining process when Shell walked away from the labor talks, triggering the strike. U.S. Secretary of Labor Thomas Perez says the Bureau of Labor Statistics 2014 Union Membership Report underscores the value of labor unions for workers. Perez says the report confirms what we've always known, that belonging to a union makes a powerful difference in people's lives, providing greater economic security and helping them punch their ticket to the middle class, according to Perez. The report says non-union workers earn just 79% of what union workers make, a difference of about $10,000 a year for union members. The report also showed that for women, being in a union means that salaries are closer to their male counterparts than those of non-union women. Perez says unions and the right to collectively bargain are more vital now than ever. Perez says when unions are strong, working families thrive and wages rise with productivity. But when union density declines, there's downward pressure on wages.
Brought to you by the IBEW, 750,000 men and women powering the way for an American comeback. Information on how to become an International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Power Professional is online at ibew.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Thank you.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview with Raed Jarar, an Iraqi blogger about the U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East, followed by Labor Radio at 6. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline, featuring the voices of those impacted by the prison industrial complex. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather for the Portland area will be rainy with a high of 49. In the evening, it will be cooler with a high of 41 and a 20% chance of rain. Today in history, on February 2, 1990, the South African president at that time, F.W. de Klerk, announced the unbanning of the African National Congress and promises to release Nelson Mandela. Apartheid was not ended until 4 years later in 1994, when the former political prisoner Nelson Mandela was elected president of South Africa. The quote of the day is from the late Nelson Mandela, who died in 2013. He said, "I learned that courage was not the absence of fear, but the triumph over it. The brave man is not he who does not feel afraid, but he who conquers that fear."
It's 5:23, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
As an old country saying puts it, money is like manure. It does no good unless you spread it around. Yet, America's corporate and political leaders have intentionally been shoveling wealth into an ever bigger pile for those at the top. They've gotten away with this by lying to the great majority, which has seen its share of America's prosperity steadily disappearing. Yes, they've told us the rich are getting richer, but that's just the natural workings of the new global economy in which financial elites are rewarded for their exceptional talents, innovation, and bold risk-taking. Horse duties. The massive redistribution of America's wealth from the many to the few is happening because the rich and their political puppets have rigged the system. Years of subsidized offshoring and downsizing, gutting labor rights, monkey wrenching the tax code, legalizing financial finagling, dismantling social programs, increasing the political dominance of corporate cash. These and other self-serving acts of the moneyed powers have created the conveyor belt that's moving our wealth from the grassroots to the penthouses. Not since the Gilded Age, which preceded and precipitated the Great Depression, have so few amassed so much of our nation's riches. Having learned nothing from 1929's devastating crash, nor from their own bank failures in 2008 that crushed our economy, the wealthiest of the wealthy fully intend to keep taking more for themselves at our expense. This is Jim Hightower saying, now, however, the people are on to their lies. Polls show that 2/3 of Americans support increased taxes on millionaires, an end to corporate tax subsidies, and policies to more evenly distribute the wealth we all help create. This rising egalitarianism shows the true American character, and it's changing our politics for the better.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
And now we go to H2O Radio for a new weekly segment called This Week in the Water, which provides news about the water situation around the world. This week includes stories about volcanoes in Iceland, Arctic water in China, and fishing in Lake Victoria, and the introduction of the Freezeway.
Today in the United States District Court in Chicago, we filed a lawsuit on Professor Salaita's behalf against the Board of Trustees of the University of Illinois and against Chancellor Phyllis Wise, President Robert Easter, Vice President Christopher Pierre, and 8 of the 9 members of the Board of Trustees. The first set of claims in this lawsuit are that the university and its top officials violated Professor Salaita's constitutional rights in 2 important ways. First, they violated his First Amendment right to free speech by firing him for his political speech, that is, for having opinions they did not like on an important public issue. Second, they violated his 14th Amendment right to due process of law by summarily stripping him of a tenured position without any notice or opportunity to be heard. The lawsuit also alleges that after obtaining Professor Salaita's acceptance of an offer and preparing for Professor Salaita's arrival on campus, such as scheduling him to begin teaching courses in the fall, the university breached its contract and promised to complete Professor Salaita's appointment to the faculty. Finally, the lawsuit also brings claims against financial donors who sought to inject themselves into the university hiring process by demanding that the university break its commitment to Professor Salaita or else they would stop donating to the university. Those donors have not yet been identified because of the university's refusal to reveal the administration's communications with donors in response to Freedom of Information requests. I want to turn now from the claims in the lawsuit to the evidence. First, what Professor Salaita does not need to prove: that the university fired him based on his tweets about Israel and Palestine during the Gaza conflict. Everyone, including the university, acknowledges that Professor Salaita's tweets were the reason for his firing. The administration's justification is that it was not the content or viewpoint of those tweets that caused his firing, but the uncivil tone of his tweets. But we will show that justification is unlawful under Supreme Court precedent. We will also show that other arguments that officials have made are plainly pretextual. For example, the charge that Professor Salaita may not be a fair teacher are demonstrably disproven by his stellar teacher evaluations, evidence that was readily available to anyone that cared to look. We intend to prove that the true motivation for the university's hasty decision was pressure from donors. Everything that the university has done since it announced its decision further confirms that improper motivation. The university says publicly that its decision was not based on donor pressure, yet it refuses to comply with the Freedom of Information requests of Professor Salaita and others for communications with donors. If the university is to be believed, why won't it release that information? The university's own Committee on Academic Freedom has made unequivocally clear that the university violated principles of academic freedom, shared faculty governance, and the university's own policies, and that justification for firing Professor Salaita, his uncivil tone, is a gross violation of principles of academic freedom and should be withdrawn. Yet, the university has refused to follow the committee's recommendation to revisit its decision. If donor pressure was not the motivation, then why won't the university follow the recommendation of respected faculty and even allow qualified academic experts to weigh in? In sum, the university administration has made claims that are contradicted by its actions. Through this lawsuit, we will put the administration's claims to the test. In the process, we hope to vindicate Professor Salaita and obtain a ruling that will allow him to join his colleagues in American Indian Studies, and in the process, help the university community get answers about how its administration thinks and operates.
Hello, everybody. This is Steve Salaita. The university's actions have caused me significant economic, emotional, and reputational damage and have taken a significant toll on my family. The firing has left my academic career, the primary mechanism for supporting my family, in shambles. Obtaining a lifetime tenured faculty position at a major American university, a product of years of study and scholarship, represented the pinnacle achievement of my professional career. This ordeal not only cost me that achievement, but I lost my prior tenured position, and the University of Illinois' defamatory attacks have made it impossible for me to obtain a tenured position at another university. I'm now jobless, and without a university affiliation, my ability to publish articles in academic journals and to present scholarship to colleagues is severely diminished. Without an income source, my wife, young son, and I have been forced to move in with my parents and now struggle to make ends meet. I deeply miss being in the classroom, where I always learned from students in addition to teaching them. My primary motivation in bringing this suit is to join my colleagues in the American Indian Studies program at UIUC and begin teaching. If the university is able to ignore its own rules and terminate a tenured faculty member for acts of extramural speech, it will have serious negative repercussions on academic freedom, faculty governance, student learning, and intellectual exchange. I do not want UIUC's illegal actions to become the norm in American universities. I have long sought to resolve this matter amicably and cooperatively without the need for a lawsuit. We bring this suit only after the university made it clear that it had no intention to follow the recommendation of its own Committee on Academic Freedom and Tenure to allow a body of qualified experts within the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences to review the matter and determine whether my appointment to the faculty should be completed. Though it bears repeating that qualified academic bodies already rigorously vetted my teaching and scholarship during the year-long application process.
Fierce fighting continues to expand across eastern Ukraine as the latest rounds of peace talks between the pro-Western Ukrainian government and the pro-Russian rebels in eastern Ukraine broke down over the weekend. Pro-Russian rebels continue to gain ground and have hundreds of Ukrainian troops surrounded in the town of Devoltsev, near Donetsk. The advances by the pro-Russian eastern Ukrainian rebel forces has caught the attention of NATO leaders. The Obama administration in Washington is actively considering plans to send up to $3 billion of heavy weaponry to the Ukrainian government troops in hopes of turning the tide of the fighting. France has announced plans to strengthen NATO forces in Poland, which borders the northwest corner of Ukraine. In mid-January, the pro-Western Ukrainian government called for a draft to conscript more troops. So far, only 10% of those called up have reported for duty. After the peace talks broke down over the weekend, pro-Russian rebel leaders called for a voluntary conscription of up to 100,000 new troops. The Ukrainian military responded by moving tanks and other heavy equipment toward the front lines in the eastern Ukraine. NATO commanders have developed plans to create several rapid response military combat units in six countries formerly part of the old USSR and now bordering either the Ukraine or Russia. Russia responded by sending two nuclear-capable stealth bombers over the English Channel with their air traffic controller beacons turned off, making the bombers invisible to normal civilian air traffic controllers. British forces sent several fighter jets to the area, which disrupted multiple civilian flights. Germany's Chancellor Angela Merkel has continued to state that the conflict cannot be solved militarily. President Obama will host Chancellor Merkel in Washington next week for talks on the Ukrainian crisis, ISIS, and the global implementation of further counterterrorism measures.
An anti-austerity rally in Spain over the weekend drew more than 100,000 people to protest official European Union economic policies. The rally was organized by the Podemos political party, a new party organized in January of 2014. The Podemos has argued that the economic policies of austerity are designed to increase unemployment and cut wages for the majority of the workers, while at the same time giving out large tax breaks and bailouts to the wealthiest corporations and individuals. In their first elections, the Podemos party gained 5 seats in the European Union Parliament and gained 8% of the Spanish vote last year. This year, Podemos is leading all major regional and national polls in Spain, joining the Syriza party in Greece as the newest political party to have electoral success by fighting against the upward redistribution of wealth known as austerity. Since 2008, the global economic crash, Spain's GDP has fallen almost 15%, and the unemployment rate is still at 25%. A level equal to the worst employment suffered by America during the Great Depression of the 1930s. The unemployment rate for Spanish youth under 25 years of age is over 50%. The wealth of the richest individuals in Spain has risen over 60% since the 2008 economic crash occurred, while the vast majority of new jobs are low-paying service sector jobs. Average wages have dropped every year since 2007, and up to one-third of all Spanish workers now make the minimum wage.
The government of Liberia began a trial of experimental Ebola vaccines today, vaccinating thousands of volunteers with two vaccines developed by the international pharmaceutical corporations GlaxoSmithKline and Merck. While the outbreak of Ebola is on the decline, Liberia remains the hardest hit. From a peak of over 1,000 cases 2 months ago, Liberia currently has less than a dozen active cases of Ebola. The vaccine trial is being carried out at the government-run Redemption Hospital in Monrovia, in the new Crewtown neighborhood that was one of the first parts of the capital to be struck by the deadly disease.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Monday, February 2nd, 2015. Israeli settlers leave 10 Palestinians injured in a number of attacks across the West Bank, and in Gaza, Israeli Navy attacks Palestinian fishing boats. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. An Israeli settler shot and injured a 17-year-old Mohammed Yusuf Burkan in the Israeli-occupied East Jerusalem neighborhood of Silwan on Monday, according to witnesses. The youth was shot while tending to a small herd of sheep in the Wadi Yasul area of the neighborhood. He used his mobile phone to call his brother, who took Mohammed to Al-Maqasid Hospital in Jerusalem for treatment. The settlers fled the scene before his brother arrived. Moreover, an Israeli settler's car on Monday ran over an inn in Bab al-Amud, also known as the Damascus Gate, in occupied East Jerusalem, said Palestinian paramedic. The inn was hit by a settler's speeding car, who also knocked down a pedestrian crossing the street, said Basim Zidani, who works as a paramedic. Zidani, who provided the inn with the emergency medical treatment at the scene, added that the inn sustained moderate injuries. The nun, who remains unidentified, was taken to Hadassah Hospital in West Jerusalem to receive further medical care. Also on Monday, an Israeli settler vehicle crashed into a car belonging to Palestinian Authority security forces near Hebron, injuring 7 security officers. Palestinian security officials told local news that the crash occurred near Al-Arub refugee camp to the north of Hebron, with initial reports indicating that the incident was deliberate. The officers were taken to hospital with light to moderate injuries in Hebron City. There are now over 500,000 Israeli settlers living in occupied East Jerusalem and the West Bank. All settlements are illegal under international law. On Monday at dawn, Israeli soldiers kidnapped at least 16 Palestinians after invading and searching their homes in different parts of the occupied West Bank, including 5 north of occupied East Jerusalem and 3 Palestinians from the eastern part of Gaza. Elsewhere, the Israeli Navy on Monday continued its daily breach of the ceasefire agreement reached on August of last year as they opened fire towards Palestinian fishermen offshore of Gaza, according to witnesses. Fishermen said that the Israeli Navy gunboats opened heavy machine gun fire randomly at fishermen sailing within the 6 nautical miles allowed fishing zone, causing damage to one of the boats, but no injuries were reported. Israeli Navy forces target fishing boats almost on a daily basis in a clear breach of the Egyptian brokered truce agreement reached in August of last year. This agreement includes allowing Palestinian fishermen to sail within 6 nautical miles in the Gaza Sea. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Monday, February 2nd, 2015 news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Bandura.
A few minutes ago, you heard the recording from Professor Stephen Salaita. He filed a lawsuit against the University of Illinois after his offer for a teaching position was rescinded when he tweeted about the Israeli attack on Gaza last summer. Professor Stephen Salaita was hired by the American Indian Studies program at the university last year. After Israel attacked Gaza, where some 2,000 people were killed, including 500 children, Salaita tweeted several times that were termed uncivil messages on his Twitter account. This was brought to the attention of the Zionist donors to the University of Illinois, who then pressured Chancellor Phyllis Wise to rescind the hiring. Supporters of the professor say that his case marks the most important case in 50 years, when in the 1960s the Supreme Court overturned the non-communist loyalty oath. Some 6,000 professors have vowed to boycott the University of Illinois.
And now we'll hear This Week in Water.
Volcanoes erupt from climate change. That and other stories for the week ending February 1st. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin. And it's This Week in Water. Iceland is on the rise, and we're not referring to its economy, which, to be fair, is doing quite well, thank you, due to a booming tourist industry.
We mean it's literally going up. According to researchers from the University of Arizona and the University of Iceland, glaciers are melting so fast that parts of the island are rising as much as 1.4 inches a year.
Put another way, as the island's ice shrinks, the land pops up, similar to a trampoline once a person jumps off.
This latest study concludes that global warming is to blame, and that the melting is happening at a faster pace than first thought.
If that weren't distressing enough, the researchers believe the extra uplift could be behind an increase in volcanic activity.
The researchers point out that the last time Iceland's glaciers got thin, about 12,000 years ago, its volcanic activity leapt 30-fold. China is facing a water crisis, and part of the solution is to transfer water from the south to the north by massive aqueducts and diversions. But China's thirst is seen as an opportunity for at least one company located far away in the Arctic.
The firm, Arctic Ice Cap Water, is hoping to export water to China and Indonesia. The company takes chunks of icebergs from a bay, melts them, and then bottles the water in, of course, plastic bottles.
There are other companies that are bottling Arctic waters for export, including Icelandic Glacial, Iceland Spring, and Snow Water. And the selling point of all these brands is purity.
In other news related to the Arctic, last week the Obama administration announced that it will propose protecting about 12 million acres in Alaska from fossil fuel exploration.
Obama said that the area is pristine and undisturbed. Not so, however, for regions off the Atlantic coast. 2 days after the Alaska announcement, the administration said it would sell oil and gas leases offshore from Virginia to Georgia.
Fish populations in Africa's largest lake are declining, which is jeopardizing the livelihoods of 2 million people.
Last week, a report by Mother Jones examined the causes for the decline in the number of fish like perch and tilapia in Lake Victoria. The causes appear to be overfishing and climate change.
Overfishing could be controlled if the local government enforced catch quotas. But in addition, some scientists believe that rising temperatures are a cause of the decline. A study of Lake Tanganyika concluded that warming waters resulted in a 30% drop in fish.
Lake Victoria is different from Lake Tanganyika, but it's hard not to draw the same conclusions. Meanwhile, some areas of the region have lost up to half of the full-time fishery workers.
The Environmental Protection Agency is tasked with protecting the waters of the United States from pollution and degradation. Last year, the agency released a proposed rule that could include wetlands and ponds in addition to the obvious rivers and streams.
Recently, the EPA released a little notice study called Connectivity of Streams and Wetlands to Downstream Waters that supports a broad interpretation of what it should be protecting.
The study concludes, among other things, that streams, regardless of their size or frequency of flow, affect downstream waters. Also, wetlands can have an impact on other waters, even when they may not be connected.
These conclusions may seem self-evident to some, but last week Republicans, joined by some Democrats, introduced a bill to limit the EPA's definition of waters of the U.S. Representative Paul Gosar, a Republican of Arizona, issued a release saying that the EPA's proposal would be a blatant overreach by the federal government.
We close today with something really cool, literally. Check out the freezeway proposed for Edmonton, Alberta.
Skip skating around in circles like you would at a rink, Matt Gibbs has a better idea. As part of his master's thesis, he decided to reimagine how people might get around his hometown and proposed trails that would be for bikes in the summer and skaters in the winter.
The temperature in Edmonton sits below zero for about 5 months of the year. While some may view that as a reason to hibernate, he saw it as a hidden opportunity, a way to make people fall in love with winter. Additionally, the freezeway could be a sustainable mode of transportation and a way to attract tourists to Edmonton.
Gibbs envisioned people skating to work, to hockey games, or just for the fun of it, with plenty of venues along the way